You are listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, broadcasting from Park City, Utah. Good morning. You are listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. My name is Allison Kulo, and I'm here with my co-host, Roger Goldman, this morning. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Allison. We've got a great show this morning. Our first guest will be Kate Schindel, the president of the Actors Equity Association, the union that represents Broadway performers and other live performers around the country. We're going to talk about the impact of the coronavirus on Broadway theaters and other live performers throughout the country.
And then next, we're going to be talking with Kate Rubalcava, and she's with the Utah Nonprofits Association, and she's joining Mountain Money this morning to talk about Utah nonprofits and how they are faring in this world of COVID, as well as how our listeners can help.
And finally, we'll be talking to Bill Coleman, longtime Park City realtor and developer, about the new Sky Ridge development and what's going on that side of the county. Mountain Money will be right back after this.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
Well, the Drifters told us the neon lights were bright on Broadway in 1963. And indeed, according to the Broadway League, Broadway shows brought in about $1.8 billion in ticket sales last year. And the industry is directly responsible for some 97,000 jobs, making it one of the largest job creators in New York City. But things aren't so bright on Broadway these days during the coronavirus pandemic. On March 12th, Governor Andrew Cuomo issued an emergency order that shut down all large public gatherings, including Broadway theaters. And then on April 24th, Actors Equity, the union that represents some 51,000 theater performers and stage managers, barred all of its members nationwide from in-person auditions, rehearsals, and performances until the union could assure the safety of its members. Live theater around the country remains basically shut down today, and Broadway has announced that it won't reopen until at least January 2021.
What has been the impact of the shutdown on the people on stage and backstage at live theater venues around the country? What will it take to get the performers comfortable working in the close conditions required for live theater? How has the union been dealing with theater owners and other entertainment providers under pressure to reopen, such as Disney? And what should the industry be able to obtain in terms of government assistance? We are fortunate today to have our guest, Kate Schindel, the president of Actors Equity. Ms. Schindel has a distinguished acting career and is former Miss America and author of the book, Being Miss America. Welcome to Mountain Money, Ms. Schindel.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for being here on Mountain Money.
No problem. So just some very small basic questions, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we figured you were in an excellent place to answer them for us. So let's start little bit about helping our audience understand who's in Actors Equity and what's happening to your members right now.
Sure. So there are a lot of people all across the country who go see theater in buildings large and small, and the actors on stage and the stage managers backstage are the people that we represent. We only do live theater, which is particularly challenging right now because all the brick and mortar theaters are basically closed down and have been for several months. And without sugarcoating it, I would characterize this period as being very difficult for our actors and stage managers, which shouldn't come as a surprise. It's very difficult to have any kind of social distance in the theater. I've become very fond of saying that it's one of the only workplaces where it's not only legal, but completely expected to be required to kiss your coworker as a condition of your job. Right. So, yeah, it's been very hard. In addition to being worried about the same things that anybody else out of work is worried about, paying your bills, keeping your health insurance. As artists, we tend to have an engine inside us that spurs us to create. And that has been very difficult during quarantine as well, although not impossible.
Do most of your members do gig employment, or are they currently able to collect unemployment under the enhanced employment benefits? Talk a little bit about the sort of economics of what's going on with your members right now.
Well, that's something that was very important to us in the early days of the pandemic, especially. Equity operates with employee contracts. So our folks are paid wages and benefits, and, you know, are paid regular income, not gig income. At the same time, we do have a lot of folks, including myself, who do that kind of work on the side and need to do that kind of work in order to supplement their income in between contracts. So although that kind of work is generally not covered by equity, we fought very hard for people who had accepted offers for shows but hadn't started work yet, or who had you know, a 1099 job, to have access to unemployment benefits, which, as you know, is not historically how that's worked. And we were incredibly relieved when that that became part of the relief packages. I can't tell you how many times I had someone call me and tell me that, you know, I lost $7,000 worth of income just today. And so, you know, those jobs, the ones performing at conventions, for example, or doing concerts with symphonies, are things that are important to our members, even if they're not stuff we traditionally cover.
With regards to getting the actors back to work and on that, you know, current or on a regular payment schedule for their bills and whatnot, what do you see needs to be taken, or what will it take to make venues reopen with Equity performers? And how did Equity decide to allow the Berkshire performances to proceed?
There are a few tent poles of reopening that are very important to us as we have been building out specific safety protocols. And the first two are the most difficult to predict. One, that the epidemic be under control in the area where the theater is operating, and two, that there be reliable testing and tracing. And those are things that we have absolutely no control over, as you can imagine, but in order to keep our folks safe, they are very important. And as you know, the epidemic has been evolving so rapidly that parts of the country that thought that they were maybe going to get hit a little less hard than New York did, for example, a few weeks ago, find themselves in a different situation now. So the reason that the Berkshire theaters were allowed to be the first ones to get contracts, which I was very excited about and continue to be, is because primarily the epidemic is under control in that area. Massachusetts is still green. We're hoping it will stay that way. And in addition to that, those theaters worked with us in order to build out safety protocols that didn't just take into consideration spacing out the audience and putting some hand sanitizer backstage. The production that Berkshire Theater Group is going to be doing is outside with a lot of distancing between the performers. And the production at Barrington Stage Company is a one-person show that I believe will have nobody backstage during the performance. So in some respects, these are test cases. In other respects, these are jobs that I think everybody looked at and said, this is a group that is trying to do the responsible thing, keep people safe, and we are eager to see how it goes.
Are other similar projects or potential projects underway? Are you talking to other theater venue owners to try to work out some other kinds of arrangements like that?
Yes, absolutely. There are dozens of safety plans that are being reviewed. And I was actually just on another call where our executive director, Mary McCall, mentioned that there were theaters that were very close to being approved because they had worked out the safety protocols that we were confident could keep people as safe as possible. Even if the risk wasn't zero, it was close enough to zero that we felt comfortable saying, okay, here are some contracts, please be careful and go do a show. But then the epidemic changed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, places, again, as I said a couple minutes ago, parts of the country where it seemed like the epidemic was just not going to be a factor are now seeing that it's a huge factor over the past couple weeks. So it's not great news. We want theaters to reopen. We want them to reopen with equity members. And we want our people to be able to get back to work, but not at the risk of their health and or their lives and the lives of their families.
Of course. I read an article that was talking about one of the theaters opening back up in the Berkshires, and the the performers were all staying in the same house, and they were all being tested. And from my understanding, it wasn't just temperature testing, but actual COVID testing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. So I think everybody's aware at this point that people can have the virus, but not be exhibiting any symptoms. Some people never exhibit any symptoms, which is why it was important to us and continues to be important to us that people be tested for the actual illness, not just a temperature check.
Ms. Schindel, something tells me that you probably were not an expert in epidemiology before you know, the recent need for you to bring yourself very much up to speed. And I imagine that's been a really interesting challenge. One of the things we've just been talking about is how, in the Berkshire example, the theater owners worked with you. Are you finding that, as a general matter, the production companies and the theater owners view themselves as aligned with you to figure out a way to get this safely, or are there, as often is the case, management labor tensions?
It depends on what time it is. Yeah, it's a spectrum, really. And I think that the right way to do this, the way that's productive for everybody, is for it to be a collaboration. You probably know that we've hired Dr. David Michaels, who is a former OSHA administrator, to consult with us on these issues, because as much as I would like to play an epidemiologist on TV, I'm vastly underqualified to be making these decisions. We have a great staff who's been working closely with both Dr. Michaels and with any number of theaters. And one of the things that he has said many times is that this is a process that will require buy-in from everybody in the theater. It can't just be the union bringing down the hammer. Everybody has to want to work collaboratively in order to not only get the protocols set up, but follow through with them. So yes, we have had theaters who have come to us and said, the Berkshire Theater Group is a great example. We want to work with you. We want to build something. We would love for it to become a template for the industry on how we can do this safely, because theater is way too important to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and its economy for us to just give up on the summer season without trying everything we can. And I think that's something that often gets missed. We tend to talk about the arts as a cultural experience, as something that people do with their disposable income in their free time. But as you mentioned early on, it is a huge economic driver. And I would argue that it's as important an economic driver in medium-sized and small cities as it is in a place like New York City. So it's essential to be getting theaters reopened responsibly as quickly as possible, but we're also engaged and have been for months in a very strong push for increased arts funding to help these organizations survive and come back after this.
We want to eventually get a little more onto that topic, but I did want to ask you about a situation which does not appear to be very collaborative, which is the publicity surrounding the opening of Disney World last week. As I understand it, the many of the live performers at Disney World are traditionally equity members, which led me, as I was driving in this morning, to wonder if I went to Disney World this week, would I see Belle as a scab?
Well, we represent about 700 to 800 members there, and about 200 of those had been recalled, meaning that they were about to go back to work. We made a very strong push for testing to be available at Walt Disney World to the performers in the same way that we're making that push all across the country. And Disney was not interested. I mean, we've talked to them over and over and over again at the negotiating table saying, listen, you don't want our performers to wear masks. You've got to do something. So my understanding is that they had the contractual right to call our members back, whether or not we came to agreement on testing. But instead, they rescinded their recalls because we declined to sign the memorandum of understanding that they put in front of us, basically agreeing to their no testing procedure. So, you know, part of what has driven the union to talk about it in the media is that it just seems to us that the public should be aware that Disney is not testing its workers. And it's not my job to represent every worker in that park, although if I were emperor, I would strongly encourage them to test all of their workers, but we felt it was very, very important. Even though we knew that Disney could legally recall our members, regardless of how this turned out, that we focus on testing.
So that the breakdown really came over the notion that there was not going to be systematic testing for COVID of the performers and at Disney World. That's really where it broke down. And which makes me wonder, do we know whether or not they're bringing in alternatives to your members? Or essentially, are we seeing the crossing of a virtual picket line by, you know, other performers replacing your equity performers in Florida?
I have heard that they're talking about reconfiguring the shows in those spaces, but I don't know all the details of that. So it would not be a show featuring non-equity performers where equity performers used to be. It would be a different concept, but I can't speak specifically to what Disney's doing behind the scenes, unfortunately.
Well, I'm going to take us back a bit to that increased arts funding that you had mentioned before. With regards to cultural tourism, which I think you were highlighting again, a lot of people don't understand how much the arts play within a tourism community. And with regards to that, not only are theaters now not able to fit the entire audience in, you know, we're seeing reductions of a theater of 700 seats to 100 or 520 seats to about 160. So not only are we not able to put enough people in seats, but how do we, you know, kind of keep the lights on while, you know, perhaps ticket sales aren't covering the basic operating costs of these venues? What type of funding have you seen put in place?
We have an outstanding $4 billion arts funding ask that would be allocated through the National Endowment for the Arts. And we are advocating and lobbying as hard as we can to get it into the relief packages. Again, economically, we can't afford to think of the arts as a luxury item. They not only support the people who work in those theaters, but also all the ancillary places, as you referenced, where theatergoers spend money. You know, Americans for the Arts estimates that I believe it's $31 per person per show that nonprofit arts attendees spend in the surrounding community. It's everything from parking garages to restaurants and bars to, you know, the other businesses that might be near the theater. And so we are lobbying at full steam for arts funding. We also have had a number of conversations about how we can adapt. So if a theater contacts Equity and says, listen, I'm hearing from my subscribers, upon which, you know, so many of these theaters depend for their survival, that they will not renew their subscription unless they have the possibility of not having to come to the theater. Can we make available some kind of virtual ticket? I mean, that's something we had never contemplated before this emergency, but it does make sense. So we've been talking with theaters about that. So if they can only fill half of their theater because the state or city mandates that, or if they just have people who are afraid, who are older, who have underlying health conditions, who don't want to share an armrest with someone, can that person access the show from their home? It seems to me to be a reasonable solution, and we are working through it as quickly as we can.
But I would guess it's also a bit of a slippery slope, because the live theater experience is just that, the live theater experience. And although we've certainly seen an enormous interest over the last couple of weeks with the Disney streaming of Hamilton, you sort of, isn't there some concern that if you go down that road, you might fundamentally undercut the economic model of live theater?
Oh, you heard about Hamilton, huh? it was sort of everywhere. We believe that live theater should be live. It's fundamental to us in every conversation that we have internally. We believe that auditions for live theater should be held in person, because that's a different experience than watching someone's tape that they made in their garage. But we're under extraordinary circumstances right now, and I would strongly opine that whatever we put in place during this crisis will be sunset in some way, and then we can take a look at what the industry looks like going forward. I have thought for a long time, actually, that more theaters should do what Hamilton ended up doing. But the largest theaters, the largest employers we have, just don't seem to want to do that because they perhaps believe that making content available to a larger audience when their show is still running on Broadway will depress their ticket sales. You know, that's not my decision above my pay grade, but I think that we're being forced into an unprecedented situation with what we're all dealing with, and our job is to be as reasonable as possible, get our people paid, and make sure that these theaters can survive.
So let's before we go, I just wonder, how do you see things playing out over the next 6 months to a year? Obviously, the virus is unpredictable, but you've started to make some progress with models like the Berkshire. Do you see, you know, the ability to continue to expand alternative ways of reaching the audience and keep your various members employed?
I absolutely hope so, and I sure wish I had a crystal ball. All we can do is make the best decisions that we can based on the available data, and then when the information changes, we adjust the strategy. I think that there will be some kind of hybrid theater-going experience for a while as theaters reopen. I strongly believe that theaters in different parts of the country will open at different times. And, you know, beyond that, it's anybody's guess. Mm-hmm. But I do know that our members, our stage managers and actors, including me, I mean, I still make my living in the industry, not from the union, very much want to get back to work. It's just a matter of making sure that it's safe and that it's not simply safe for young, healthy people who feel like if they contracted this virus that they could probably make it through. We have to make it safe for our older actors and stage managers and people with underlying health conditions. I mean, that's the whole point of a union. Mm-hmm. So we're going as fast as we can. We wish the virus would hurry up and go away. And until then, our focus just has to be on safety.
Kate, no, I think this has been a great conversation. You did mention that the National Endowments of the Arts is looking to put together some legislation. Is there a place where our listeners could go and help support that?
Sure. If you visit actorsequity.org, I am confident that we have some pointers to action items that people can get into. We have, you know, any number of outstanding petitions and letters that can be signed on to. We also have an emergency relief fund set up through an organization called the Actors Fund. Our fund is called the Curtain Up Fund. So if those who have been hit a little less hard by the virus would like to make a donation for emergency relief to actors and stage managers who are really in crisis, like can't pay their bills, need a surgery, check out the Curtain Up Fund at actorsfund.org.
Kate, thank you for spending time with us. We've been speaking with Kate Schindel. She's the president of the Actors Equity Association, and you're listening to Mountain Money. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KPCW's Mountain Money. We are seeing quite a bit heading our way. As we look in the past, 10 years after the Great Recession began, the public's need for human services was even greater in three-quarters of the states before the recession. Many of these needs are met by nonprofits. The increasing needs of human services from COVID will strain the ability of many nonprofits, especially small to mid-sized nonprofits in local communities, to keep up with the needed services.
Not only will America's 1.3 million charitable nonprofits be called upon to meet these needs, they themselves are facing impacts from COVID-19 that are jeopardizing their ability to exist. The Utah Nonprofits Association, in conjunction with the National Council of Nonprofits, is soliciting the support to advocate for nonprofit policy solutions in the COVID-19 economic relief bill that lawmakers are negotiating now to pass by the end of July. Kate Rubalcava, the CEO of the Utah Nonprofits Association, joins us this morning to talk about Utah nonprofits, what Utah nonprofits are facing, and how listeners can help. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the big picture. What are we seeing in terms of the current status of the broad spectrum of Utah nonprofits? Are they obviously, the demands on them are going up. Are they faring well in terms of their ability to fulfill their various missions?
I think that's a mixed question. Rather, it's a mixed answer. So many of the nonprofits in our community are facing grave challenges in adjusting to the impacts of COVID-19, which has, you know, triggered an economic downturn in the middle of some racial unrest within our community. So really, nonprofit organizations are trying to lead through a trifecta of events that are just making it really challenging right now for the charitable nonprofits in our communities.
Perhaps you could give us a sense of who those nonprofits are and how big the nonprofit community is in Utah.
The nonprofit community is over 10,000 large here in the state of Utah. And over the past several years, it's grown exponentially. Since 2014, for example, our sector has grown almost 24%. But from the period of September 2018 to September 2019, the sector grew about 3.8%. And we're talking about nonprofits of all sizes and in all subsectors of our community, including human services, arts and culture, education, religion, animals and environmental-based, and then also membership organizations and international and foreign affairs organizations.
And where are you seeing the biggest strains in terms of the current situation, both in terms of services being demanded and in terms of funds being required?
The biggest challenges that we're seeing are in organizations being able to raise the revenue to do the mission-based work that they need to be able to do. So what we saw initially in the initial wave of coronavirus cases in March, we saw that organizations, by and large, had to cancel events, had to think differently about their, philanthropic events that they were doing, change in programming. So we saw about $11.2 million lost in revenue from organizations, which I think is really challenging to think about when you're looking at the larger scale for nonprofit viability. And some of the most interesting things that we saw also were that nonprofit organizations had to fork out at least $4 million in unbudgeted expenses in order to be able to shift programming so that they could do remote work.
That's a large hardship, $4 million worth of expenses just to be able to do the work that they were doing before the pandemic.
Right. And that's unplanned, budgeted, right? Like, that's not just, oh, we were planning to make upgrades. These are unplanned expenses.
So again, yeah, not in the budget. Now an additional fund that they need to raise money for.
One of the things that you just touched on, which is interesting, is that the way in which nonprofits create revenue is largely or significantly by in-person philanthropic events. In other words, I think that the nonprofit community really raises money often through these kinds of live events, whether they be charitable auctions, whether they be balls, whether they be similar kinds of things. And I take it those have all come to a complete stop. Am I right that that's a significant component of how nonprofits typically function in the state?
Nonprofit organizations certainly do get a lot of their revenue through community support in that way. Some organizations have been able to shift to online fundraisers, and they've been received with mixed success. I think also there's just a challenge of how to put together an event of that scale online, the relationship that you might have with donors, because donors often really do like the name recognition, and they really like to be able to go to an event, to show their support, to see their logo, to really, show that community support that they can receive and at an event, and when it's been held online and your reach looks different. I mean, that exposure shifts.
So, again, as you've mentioned, that there's not only these unanticipated costs, but nonprofits, as always, are constantly trying to fine-tune their budget and be able to provide as many services as possible for the least amount of cost. And one of the numbers I saw this weekend was that 10% of America's private workforce is employed or employs non, let me say this a different way. Nonprofits employ more than 10% of America's private workforce. So that's more than manufacturing, construction, and finance. So these nonprofits have major decisions they're facing. Not only are they facing increased costs, but they're also facing the fact that they may not be able to provide or to be able to raise the enough revenues to pay for their just normal services. So what types of decisions are the nonprofits making right now with regards to how they're operating?
That is such a loaded question, and you're right to say that nonprofit organizations are huge economic drivers within our communities, and nonprofits are faced with adjusting the number of clients they can or cannot serve, depending on what their mission looks like. They are faced with the challenge of closing their doors, narrowing scope. They're faced with furloughing and or excusing staff from their workforce. They are faced with the challenges of really trying to figure out how to do the work of our mission with a lemon that has been fully squeezed. And, what I'm seeing is that nonprofit organizations, in spite of really dire circumstances, really are coming through this pandemic, this economic unrest, these racial injustices that we're facing in our community. And they're really stepping up to the challenge and coming together as a community to help us make proper policy, to serve the community in a way that the community continues to need to be served.
As the pandemic has proceeded, we've seen a lot of economic threats to for-profit businesses and have even seen some forced to close the doors. Are you seeing any nonprofits that have been squeezed so heavily here in Utah that they are not able to continue? Are we seeing, obviously, I suspect we're seeing some furloughs and layoffs, but are we seeing any organizations that actually can't make it work and have actually gone under?
Yes, we are. Anecdotally, I am hearing from nonprofit executives and boards that are just not able to continue. They're realizing that the operations that they had been really running their organization was at a shoestring already, and it was being further taxed, and they were just unable to continue. I don't have an exact number, but anecdotally, I think that is fairly common, particularly among smaller nonprofit organizations.
And that's unfortunate. With regards to the CARE Act, I know that the Utah Nonprofits Association is helping lobby for changes to the CARES Act and that legislation to help nonprofits. What types of items need to be included within this next round to be able to help nonprofits?
There are three key items that we're really focusing on. Right now at the federal level, we are hoping to expand charitable deductions for an above-the-line deduction for individuals so that they can contribute to nonprofit organizations. We are also really working on making some changes around unemployment insurance. At present, what happens for nonprofit organizations is that they are, when they do receive an unemployment claim, they need to come up with 100% of the unemployment cost, and then the state will reimburse them for 50%. That is if they are self-insured. So what ends up happening is it creates a cash flow problem for a nonprofit organization that is already experiencing some challenges with cash flow to come up with 100% of the unemployment claims for any employees that they've either had to furlough or let go during this time. And then the last piece that we're really focusing on is increases in the payment protection plan so that we can make sure that some smaller nonprofit organizations can get access to the funds so that they can receive some really critical funding to allow their organization to keep staff employed. Now, all of those things are really taking place on a federal level. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that on a state level, the Utah Nonprofits Association is presently looking to expand charitable deductions similarly to what we're looking for federal taxes, but for state income taxes. So we currently have bill language written up, and we're looking for bill sponsors to help us get charitable deductions, you know, during our special session in August for this bill to be heard so that we can funnel some necessary and very critically important revenue into nonprofit organizations.
So just to make sure our audience understands and to make sure I understand, under current tax law, charitable deductions only kick in, if you will, to the extent that you have deductibles that go above the standard deduction. So,
correct.
And so what you're suggesting, though, is that charitable deductions would be deducted immediately sort of over and above the standard deduction. Is that how that would work?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. And that's being that's a lobbying effort that's being done by, I take it, a national. Are you affiliated with a national nonprofit association that's really spearheading that effort? Because that, you know, given this Congress, that sounds like a heavy lift.
It's not as heavy as one might imagine. We've got bipartisan support of senators and Congress folks across both aisles, mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C., and across the state. We are working with the National Council of Nonprofits to work to make this legislation really appropriate and smart for nonprofits across this good country.
I was going to say that one of the things that the Utah Nonprofits Association does is provide training, training for the nonprofits. And you describe it as learning opportunities designed to help run leaner, smarter, and faster, and go deeper into topics that matter. What topics have you added to the calendar that address issues that are related to COVID-19 that the nonprofits are seeking education on?
When nonprofit organizations, let's be frank, when the entire country had a reckoning in March about stopping the spread of this global pandemic, many nonprofit organizations went into remote work, and, you know, the first round of the CARES package came out, which authorized the PPP and the EIDL loans. And so what we found was there was a huge gap in organizations needing access to what are all of the things, and this is broad, but what are all of the things we need to know to operate in a remote work environment? So we've been offering things like how to do a deep dive into Zoom, because much of what we do now takes place online, and helping everybody understand how to utilize that platform in a way that can really engage your audience. We provided several sessions on PPP loans and the EIDL loans so that they could understand what that looked like. And we also did a number of sessions policy related, engaging with our federal delegation and also some state elected officials to really provide some feedback so that our voices can be heard as they are making legislation that impacts the nonprofit community as a whole. So we haven't done a complete shift in the coursework that we have been offering, but we have really honed in on how can we support nonprofits as they're working from their living rooms so that they can still continue to do the mission critical work that fuels their nonprofit organization.
You know, before we go, I think it would be useful if you could talk to our listeners a little bit about what they can do if they want to support the efforts of the nonprofit community to get governmental support at both the state and federal level.
First and foremost, what I would encourage you to do on the federal level is to reach out to your senators and your representatives and ask them to support legislation that positively impacts nonprofit organizations by way of expanding charitable deductions, by way of increasing the PPP loans, and making sure that unemployment insurance can go back to a more cost-effective model for nonprofit organizations. At a local level, I would encourage you to start having conversations with your state senators and representatives and ask them what can be done to make an expansion of charitable deductions similar to what's happening at the federal level. Then I think on a more personal level, what's really important for folks to understand is that if there is a nonprofit out there that you know, love, trust, and support them. Give them a financial donation. Call them up. Find out how they can utilize your talent, your time, and your services. Nonprofit organizations across Utah are really dependent on being engaged in the community and having the community engaged with us. So if we can find whichever lane makes sense for us, if it's calling an elected official, fantastic. If it's writing a check, that's better. If it's a combination of both, that's also really phenomenal. But just figuring out what that lane is for you and how you feel comfortable. But nonprofit organizations are here to stay. We are, I really truly believe, stronger than ever, because when you can gather together, learn from one another, and emerge through the chaos that we have had in 2020, we are going to come out of the end of this just a more vibrant nonprofit sector.
We've been talking to Kate Balaclava. Did I pronounce that correctly? I'm going to get it right.
Rubicava.
Rubicava. Yeah, I turned you into a hat. We've been talking to Kate Rubicava of the Utah Nonprofit Association. Thank you for spending time with us. Mountain Money, we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to KPCW's Mountain Money. We are joined next by Bill Coleman. Bill has over 45 years of experience as a developer and realtor in both Summit and Wasatch counties. And Bill is joining us today to give us an update on Sky Ridge, a four-season master planned community located on the northwest shores of the Jordanelle Reservoir. Bill, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Allison. This is good to be able to be on your radio station.
Thank you, and I'm happy to have you. And we are doing all our interviews via phone, so thanks for joining in that way as well. So I wanted to ask you, the range and the depth of your work in the area of Wasatch and Summit County has spanned decades, and you started work on the Sky Ridge development in the mid-'80s. What was the vision for the property then, and how did you think at that time it would integrate into the community?
The actual beginning of all of the area in and around Sky Ridge started actually in the 70s when Bill Gardner built a real estate subdivision over there called East Park. But then it really changed drastically when the Mayflower group, which is a group of almost a couple hundred Dutch guys in Holland, got together and decided they wanted to make an American investment, bought about 5,000 acres over here. And the part of it that's on the east side of the of Highway 40 that everybody's always known as just sort of a part of the edge of the lake, I guess. It's a rather large section of ground, and it's over 600 acres sitting there. But it's also begun. We began its re-entitlement with the Wasatch County almost 4 years ago. And overall, all the Mayflower stuff, Bob Theobald and myself have been working on for almost 6 years, and Bob's been working on it for 35 years since the 80s. But we just started the heavy part of Sky Ridge, getting it approved fairly recently, in the sense that's only a couple years old. And they're just paving it finally today.
And what is the status of the entitlements at this point for Sky Ridge? Where are you, and how long do you expect the process to be before, you know, the lots are available for sale?
Well, we actually completed that about almost a year ago. 503 ERUs, equivalent residential units, is what we call them, and these are all single-family lots. And there's about 483 of them that are just pure lots. And there's a couple of amenities in there, a stables and a horse facility, equestrian facility, and then also a short course, par three, kind of a golf course. They're open to the public and all part of the overall MIDA development project area. So we're participating in all of that. And so it's up and running now. It's approved. We've been making sales. We've got 65 of the units are the first phase of 132 lots are sold. 26 additional ones are under contract. And what's interesting is there's about 30 of these that we've sold already over there that have Park City addresses, the people that are buying them. And so it's an awful lot of locals that have gone over there and purchased lots and moved just a little bit out of town, but not too far, and definitely at the base of our amenities of the ski areas. And a lot of it comes, I think, too, because of how associated it is with the trail system. And right. It's all getting completed now.
And so you've closed a number of these lots. Is there sufficient infrastructure in place to allow people to start breaking ground on buildings? And if not, when do you think that'll be?
That should be soon. They're just paving literally today two of the subdivisions in there, the first three. Two of those happen right away, and there'll be another one done in about a month. But the main thing has to happen is that the Jordanell Parkway, which is that main road you see being built in there for the last year, is going to get paved in July of this year, late July, about the 20th. So it's going to be paved as well. And that's kind of had to have that done first before anything else could be done. But there in the meantime, they've been building the trails. We're starting on our almost 20 miles of trails, and Mountain Trails is doing the original work, and that's going all the way up to what's now called Sky Ridge Peak, that peak that you see out there along the edge of the lake.
So you've mentioned that the Jordanell Parkway was kind of a key piece that needed to be in place in order for the development to continue. I also know there's some tunnels that are going to be going under 40 that will assist. But my understanding and what I was anticipating this spring was to see just a mass amount of construction there on both sides of Highway 40 with regards to MIDA and the Mayflower development. What's mm-hmm. actually taken place this spring with everything happening with regards to the pandemic?
Well, the pandemic is impactful to everybody. Real estate has been the least probably impacted as far as the interest in our lot sales, and then all the sales all throughout town. Sales are very good, surprisingly good, considering how impactful the COVID-19 problem has been. But in this case, we've been able to get through 90% of all the issues that we have. But financing is a big one, and the Extel development over on Mayflower side is working itself. They're doing a lot of work in spite of the fact that you don't see anybody up there digging right now while they reassess all the details and the specifications going into that hotel that's being built. It's all the foundations and everything area is all been scraped away and everything, but they're stopped right now while they're waiting for more financing to be completed. Bonding capacity is a big thing. It's a big part of the whole MIDA development. And that got hit pretty hard by the markets during the coronavirus break here that we've been in. So it just slowed it down, but they've been working very heavily on getting that stuff done. Those two underpasses are going to be done, though, this fall. And they're not tunnels anymore. They're full-blown underpasses. So the one is right there at the bottom of the gondola at Deercrest, and the other one's just below the Mayflower entrance. As you go in down into the state park, it's just before you get to the resort itself, the new village of the Extel village is being built. So it's moving along pretty good speed, considering, and those being done this fall will make a big difference to connecting both sides of US 40.
And I imagine that would be a really important amenity for the Sky Ridge development, the ability to go under that, under 40, and get from Sky Ridge almost directly over to the Mayflower base. Is that what's anticipated?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you don't have to go through that, through the intersection there where you drop off to come down into the state park, which is pretty busy a lot of the times. But yeah, it's a big spread to get all of that land connected. because it's economically connected. It's also the trails. Everything get connected through those same underpasses. And definitely this little shuttle now takes care of what we can do for our guests and residents at Sky Ridge. And just you're over there in 2 minutes, the bottom of the gondola.
And just so I understand, we said there will be a shuttle that you got that will be run from Sky Ridge over to the gondola?
Yeah. Yes, we'll do that from just for our owners over there. But also we've got with those two amenities, it helps the ski side of things and all the real estate that's going to be developed over on that west side of 40 to be able to come over and enjoy the little golf facility or the equestrian center or getting closer to the lake quicker. This has all been part of the plan since the 80s to make sure that all this was connected, and it's finally happening.
So as you've mentioned, you have done well with selling of the lots and people are expressing interest in the property. I think just as our final point here, talk about those amenities that Sky Ridge has. Is there access to the Jordan L water from the subdivision as well?
Well, yes and no. We're building a pathway, we hope, down now to the lakeside from, you see that the new parkway that goes in, everything below that parkway down to the water is owned by the Bureau of Reclamation. And so there's no other houses below that road. There's just some trails. We're enhancing those trails right now, and hopefully we'll have that access. But there's not going to be a marina or a dock and all that stuff down there. But there will be some facilities that we're working on with the Bureau of Reclamation to make sure that we've made it at least a nice day area down there for ourselves. But remember, it's open to the public, too. Everything in Sky Ridge is open to the public. It's not a gated facility. It's none of that, and neither of the amenities are private. They're all public, so they'll have access. And the trail system and the trail heads that are being built in there right now, Tyler Aldis, who runs the project, has been real active in getting those trail heads built first. And Charlie's got the first ones built already up to the top of the peak, and he's just stunning to get up to the top and look out over the whole area, and you're looking down at the lake and, of course, at Deer Valley.
Absolutely. Well, Bill, thank you for spending time with us. We've been speaking with Bill Coleman with regards to Sky Ridge, a four-season development taking place on the Jordanelle shores. Bill, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Allison.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.